From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Sausalito.
Japantown, San Francisco.
Berkeley, California.
Coming up, we visit a hub for East Oakland youth that's facing some hard times.
He comes here and he can tell his friends, I'm boxing, I'm going to the gym, I'm boxing. There's no questions asked.
Also, how much of our civil liberties are we giving up to the wars on terror and crime?
The system of freedom depends on checks and balances and institutions that are built into the system, not on the goodwill of particular individuals.
And we'll meet the Bay Area's hippest librarian. She probably knows more about your Kindle than you do.
People will stop me on the street and say, hey, didn't you say something that Amazon is keeping all our information? Tell me more about that.
We've got plenty of information for you today on Cross Currents. East Oakland can be a tough neighborhood for a kid. It's a landscape designed for industry, not for children, and there aren't many places to play. But a couple of blocks east of the 880 freeway, down 98th Avenue, is a little refuge that serves as a second home and playground for those growing up in East Oakland. It's the East Oakland Boxing Association, and KALW's Nathaniel Johnson has this story from our archives.
The gym is a little smaller than a basketball court, with high ceilings. Years ago, it was an auto body shop, and all the exercise gear bears the marks of years of use. Free weights are pitted with dents. Right now, one 13-year-old is working the speedball, while older boys spot each other to lift weights and do sit-ups in the raised ring. One of the boxers finishes his routine and pulls on his gloves. His name is Christian Palou, and he's pretty much grown up now. But when he first came here, he was just 8 years old. That's when he met the man who started this gym, Stanley Garcia.
I knew Stanley since I was 8 years old. My mother, I don't like to be well too open, but since my family has been clean, I can say certain stuff. My mother used to, you know, traffic drugs or whatever. Mm-hmm. She used to bring me here, and he knew of it. He knew my mother so well that he let me work out and stuff.
It was a safe place for Palou, and people he met there became like family to him.
Stanley Garcia and Paul Wright, they were like the first two men I ever seen as a minority that I can respect and say those were men.
Palou became entranced with boxing, and now he's a serious competitor. He still trains regularly here at the gym. For the toughest kids, boxing provides a way for them to channel the need to prove themselves into discipline. But not all the kids who come here actually come to train, says Coach Jamal Valdez Allen.
Sometimes it's a good excuse. They can say, oh, well, you know, I'm going to the boxing gym. You know, like, they won't get teased or anything. I'm going to the boxing gym, even though they're really coming to do homework.
There's a lot more to the East Oakland Boxing Association than just pugilism. But Executive Director Elizabeth Kendall says she knows that the boxing is worth something when it comes to credibility on the street.
This one kid, you know, he's one of those tough kids. You see him on the street and, you know, think, oh, you know, he's up to no good. But he comes here and he can tell his friends, I'm boxing. I'm going to the gym. I'm boxing. There's no questions asked. This kid comes and has learned how to sew, can make jewelry, gets his homework done.
In the building next to the gym, a dozen younger kids are spread out around tables. Some are working with a tutor, a couple are reading, and a few are lying on the stage, meticulously filling in what looks like abstract patterns on a set of pages with paintbrushes.
We're painting a poster for Obama.
Oh, okay.
And we're going to put it on the wall.
So this is going to be Obama? That's when you put all the pieces together?
See? You don't see his eye?
9-year-old D'Angelo seems happy to be making art, but if he gets bored, there's also a computer lab, a library, a fashion and sewing club, and today, he could help make a sweet potato salad.
You see how this one side which you own is white and that side is yellow? You gotta bring them together. I told you, your arm was gonna get tired.
That's Gerard Priestess, known around here as Chef Gerard. One of his students is mixing mayonnaise into the salad. Another is butterflying shrimp. They're preparing a special meal for their Black History celebration.
I'm from the South, so this is the time where, you know, all locally grown organic and health stuff is out the door. You can do it at least once a year. You know, the rest of the year we strictly greens, red, yellows, purples, you know, oranges.
Do you cook for the kids every day?
No, I don't cook for the kids. We cook together.
The kids get a meal every day and they learn to cook it. Like many of the activities here, it's an idea that came from the children themselves. And Chef Girard says that cooking is a necessary life skill. It's the flip side of physical fitness. If you want to have good nutrition on a budget, you have to learn how to cook.
I mean, that dollar hamburger sound pretty good, but really it's not.
That lesson goes beyond the kitchen here, all the way back to the garden behind the gym, where the youth grow their own food. Kendall points out the lettuce and peas and herbs the kids planted in raised beds here. It's a beautiful little garden. The sound of big rigs whooshing by on the other side of the fence only makes it feel more like a sanctuary.
It's amazing how different it feels here.
And it's huge. You know, it's a safe space. We're able to have the kids come out and exercise out here and play in the grass without really worrying about, you know, all the different dangers that are associated with some parks. And it's an oasis, really.
The whole place is an oasis, a place where kids can come for free and do just about everything that kids like to do. The East Oakland Boxing Association manages to keep this all patched together and moving by writing grants and receiving help from foundations and community members. When Stanley Garcia first opened his gym back in 1984, he wanted to do much more than make great boxers. He wanted to make great human beings. And so the gym grew to meet the demands of the youth. And so when Mina Najim, the program's art director, looks around the kids painting and reading, she sees something that you might not associate with the boxing gym.
And I always feel like this place right here is like our living room. You know, when Chef Girard cooks, I think he cooks like, you know, he's cooking for his own kids. And I treat the kids the way my mom treated me, kindness and love.
Kindness and love may seem like an odd thing to combine with boxing. But for the kids, it works. In a way, it's been the kids who have designed this place. The adults have just followed their direction, trying to meet the needs when the children say they need access to a computer or a place to make art or after-school snacks. And this eclectic combination allows other unlikely combinations to work as well. Coaches say that sometimes even rival gang members will come into the gym, drop their colors, and work out peacefully side by side. For Cross Currents, I'm Nathaniel Johnson.
Last October, the East Oakland Boxing Association's president, Frank Rose, died. And so did the funding he worked to get every year. Now the association's struggling to make the $200,000 it needs to stay open till the end of the year, and it might have to shut down. If you want to contribute, we'll show you how at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. As we head into election season, many people are thinking about the federal policies that have changed our lives over the past 4 years, from economy to national security. Many of the people who voted for President Obama the first time did so based on campaign promises like this one.
I will provide our intelligence and law enforcement agencies with the tools they need to track and take out the terrorists without undermining our Constitution and our freedom. That means no more illegal wiretapping of American citizens. No more national security letters to spy on citizens who are not suspected of a crime.
That speech was made in 2007 as then-candidate Obama took on the Bush administration's controversial Patriot Act. Then, 4 years later, we woke up to this news.
President Obama signed into law a 4-year extension of the Terrorism Fighting Patriot Act. The Senate and House passed the extension just before it was due to expire. That bill extends the life of roving wiretaps, court-ordered searches of business records, and the surveillance of suspects without known ties to terrorist groups.
Last month, two Democratic senators sent a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder expressing concern over how the administration interprets the Patriot Act, saying the public would be alarmed if they knew the extent to which the government is using its Patriot Act powers. Pulitzer Prize winner David Shibler has been a New York Times correspondent in Israel and Moscow. In his two most recent books, released earlier this year, he turns his attention to the erosion of civil liberties in the U.S. In his books Rights at Risk and The Rights of the People, Shibler argues that both the war on terror and the war on crime have allowed the government to seep into Americans' personal lives in unconstitutional ways. Shibler recently stopped by the station to discuss his new books with KALW's criminal justice editor, Rena Palta.
A lot of people, I guess, associate the decline in civil rights for the purposes of security as associated with the post 9/11 era. And I think you say that it started even before then.
Yes, it did. I mean, certainly if you look at the Fourth Amendment, for example, which governs the government's ability to do searches of you or surveillance, the book I wrote about that goes into pre-9/11 situations in which ordinary crime was the reason for relaxing restraints on the police. So I spent time with police in Washington, D.C., two units in particular, an undercover narcotics squad and a gun squad. The gun squad's job was to get guns off of people. It was illegal for them to have guns on their person. So in the middle of the night, they'd go off and they would arrive in black neighborhoods, pull up in marked cars. The police were wearing uniforms because they wanted to see how people reacted when they arrived. And the way people reacted, they thought, indicated whether they had a gun or not. What happened, in fact, was that young men standing around on a warm night would just pull up their T-shirts without even being asked to show that they didn't have guns. Police officers would go up and they'd say, you know, good evening, gentlemen. Got any guns or drugs this evening? Sort of like, you know, can I bum a cigarette? And then they'd chat them up and they say, you know, can we just do a quick search, you know, and they would pat them down. Under the law, the police do not have the authority to frisk you on the street unless they have reasonable suspicion to believe that you're armed. But they went ahead and did this, and mostly because people acquiesced. I mean, they didn't object. They might have objected inside their own heads, but they didn't overtly say, you can't search me. If they had, the police would not legally have been able to do that. Basically, what this means is that the Fourth Amendment, as one federal judge said to me, he said, you know, the Fourth Amendment is practically non-existent in criminal law anymore because the courts have been so permissive. They've allowed the police to do so searches in so many situations without warrants that the Fourth Amendment has really been gutted.
So I'm speaking with David Shipler, and we're about to move on to national security issues in relation to his new books, Rights at Risk and the Rights of the People. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about the Brandon Mayfield case and kind of how that fits into your narrative in the book.
Brandon Mayfield was a Portland, Oregon lawyer who was mistakenly identified as having a fingerprint on a plastic bag of detonators found near the Madrid train bombings. The Spanish National Police found the print on the bag, sent it around through Interpol. It arrived at the FBI, and the FBI lab in Quantico, Virginia, used a computer system to generate, I think, about 20 possible matches. They found what they thought was a match and identified it as belonging to Mayfield. When they found out that Mayfield had converted to Islam and went to the same mosque as some men who were locked up for terrorism because they had tried to get to Afghanistan after 9/11 to fight with the Taliban, this group was called the Portland Seven, they thought they had their man. And they sent his print to the Spanish National Police, who said, no, it's not a match. And the FBI was so determined to make it a match that they kept sending agents at our expense as taxpayers to Madrid to try to persuade the Spanish police that this was a match. After they got the print, they used a secret warrant. This is a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA as it's called, is a law that was put into force in 1978 to protect privacy in the United States from intelligence gathering without good cause. And this law was amended and loosened after 9/11. So the FBI, with a warrant, did what they call sneak and peek searches. They sent people into Brandon Mayfield's home when he wasn't there, and they copied his computer hard drives. They took samples of DNA. They took 300 and some photographs, cigarette butts, all that kind of stuff. They also left some telltale signs of their presence. So Brandon had a kind of eerie feeling that he was being watched. He didn't really know. Actually called the police, and the police asked if they wanted him to do anything. Was anything missing? And Brandon said, I don't know, nothing seems to be missing, but it's really strange, the whole thing. And what was really troubling about this, I think, in the end, was the fact that once they had developed a theory of the crime, or a theory of Mayfield's involvement, they refused to acknowledge contradictory evidence. For example, Mayfield had not been outside the United States for 10 years, and he didn't even have a valid passport. But and that might have been a tip-off that he didn't go to Madrid and, you know, handle detonators, right, in a plastic bag. But instead of accepting that, the FBI concluded that he must have traveled under an alias with forged documents. So that kind of thing. So they were very determined to see Mayfield branded as the culprit. And it was only after the Spanish National Police actually found the person whose fingerprint was on the bag in Madrid that Mayfield was cleared. Otherwise, I think there's a good chance he'd be in prison now.
So is this kind of thing exceptional, or has this been happening a lot?
You know, we don't know, because the FISA warrants are secret and the searches are secret. So we don't know the extent to which innocent people have been placed under surveillance.
It's interesting because this is kind of an era where our norms about privacy are changing a lot. You know, Google reads our email already just to decide which advertisements to show us.
Right.
And I kind of wonder, I mean, there's already been a certain segment of the population who's always said, you know, what's the harm? If I'm not doing anything wrong, who cares if the government's reading this and that of my personal correspondence? And the norms seem to be going even more that way. So is it true that we're coming to the point where Americans maybe don't care if their privacy is being compromised for public safety?
First of all, ask Brandon Mayfield, the lawyer in Portland, Oregon, whether you don't have anything to worry about if you're doing nothing wrong. He was doing nothing wrong. He was jailed. He came within an inch of being prosecuted for terrorism. It was only the Spanish National Police's insistence that his fingerprint didn't match that saved him. So I don't think that that's a good response. That means you trust the officials in government enormously to do the right thing, to be intellectually honest, to test evidence. And I think we know from our own history, as well as the history of other countries, that the system of freedom depends on checks and balances and institutions that are built into the system, not on the goodwill of particular individuals. You know, at the Constitutional Convention, James Madison said famously, all men having power ought to be distrusted to a certain degree. And nothing has changed. So it's a dangerous moment, I think, in our history when the surveillance is invisible and therefore we're not very concerned about it.
That was David Shipler, author of the books Rights at Risk and The Rights of the People, speaking with KALW's Rena Palta. And we'd like to hear your view on the tension between privacy and national security. Post on our Facebook page. We're KALW News. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Wiretapping our phones may cause civil liberty concerns, but how about virtual tracking of every step you take on the internet? Your likes, interests, even your personal information, like how old you are, whether you're single or married, or how much you weigh? Well, in 2003, librarian Sarah Houghton got tired of having to wander around the internet looking for information about technology and web privacy. So she stopped looking and made a blog of her own. She called it Librarian in Black so that her blog would match her wardrobe. She talked to KALW's Holly McDeed about her fans and her opinions on online privacy.
Using all the potentially offensive stereotypes you can muster, draw a picture of a librarian in your brain. Got it? Does your visualized librarian have gray hair, giant glasses, and is she mouthing the words, "Shh, this is a library"? Well, think again.
I definitely do not fit that description. I think my mom would be the first one to tell you that I'm never hesitant about expressing my opinion.
That's Sarah Houghton. She's the acting library director for the San Rafael Public Library. She's young, has no glasses, and her hair is actually not gray, but is sprinkled with dashes of blue. She has a tattoo on her arm of Alice, as in Alice in Wonderland, and Pooh, as in Winnie the Pooh, reading under a tree.
Okay, all right. So, what did you have for breakfast this morning?
Hash browns, roasted tomatoes, roasted
When I sit down to talk to her, she's dressed in all black, which might be why people call her the librarian in black. It's also the name of the blog she's been running since 2003.
Welcome to episode 6 of What Sarah Said. Today's question comes to us from Linda, and she asks, if I have bought a Kindle book and want to lend it to a friend, can I send it to her Kindle to read with the assumption that she will send it back to me when she's finished or delete the book from her Kindle? Well, Linda, no, you can't do that.
It's a blog about technology in libraries, and it gets 1,500 hits a day. This blog has made Houghton the rock star of the librarian world. All right. Part of the reason is because she's not afraid to step on people's toes. Her opinions have gotten her fans around the globe, and they have also made some companies pretty angry.
We're always thinking about, well, how can I make this best for the other person? And so we don't speak out when things go wrong. We just don't say anything. That's how you know something's bad, is the librarians are quiet.
When Houghton started blogging, blogs were just starting to become popular. She was at a conference where librarians were encouraged to start blogs of their own.
You could start one of these magical websites called blogs and reach out to people. And I remember them saying, if you have something to say, this is a way to say it.
It was also one of the few blogs out there about libraries and technology, so she stood out. Because of her signature black, she, the librarian in black, often gets recognized in San Rafael.
People will stop me on the street and say, hey, you're that librarian, or hey, I read that article about you, or hey, didn't you say something that Amazon is keeping all our information? Tell me more about that. So,
when it comes to libraries and technology, a lot has changed since back when Houghton was growing up. Remember card catalogs?
When I was a kid, there was no real technology in libraries. I remember when they first had audio cassettes that you could check out, and that was so exciting.
Librarians were the gatekeepers, and to get anything done, you had to ask the librarian. Now it's different. Everything is stored on the internet.
Now libraries are just, you know, free Wi-Fi hotspots with tons of public computers, laptops you can check out. In some libraries, librarians are using iPads or smartphones to help you find stuff or to look stuff up for you or check stuff out to you even. Self-checkout stations where that's all computerized. I mean, everything is computerized.
As cool as all that sounds, Houghton has some serious concerns. She describes the digital content arena as something like the Wild West. It's a bit lawless, because everyone is still figuring out what works and what doesn't. Meanwhile, library ebook lending has increased up to 400%. She's worried about the fact that libraries don't actually own these ebooks.
The problem is the way that the licensing works with the digital content. Unlike with a physical book or a physical piece of music, libraries don't own it. And so we can't guarantee in any way that we'll still have access to that piece of information.
She's also worried about user privacy.
So hello, Amazon, hello, Overdrive, and hello, librarians. So I think there are a lot of things about this service that distress me. And as Bobby Newman said,
in what is, in Houghton's own words, a video rant, she criticizes the Kindle's practice of storing user information, which could be used to violate the Reader's Privacy Act. This act requires government agencies to obtain a court order before they access records regarding books purchased or loaned to any reader. But when patrons check out library books using a Kindle, they supply all their personal information to Amazon. And librarians won't be able to stop Amazon from giving over the patron's information. As a librarian, this puts Houghton in a gray area that leaves her uncomfortable.
Because how do you tell people, well, this great device that works really well and it's the smoothest checkout process of any device or format that we offer here in the library, but it violates your privacy, it jeopardizes your intellectual freedom, and, you know, it might kind of be against state law, but I'm not really sure. How do you say that to people? But I think it's important.
But she's also optimistic. Howden thinks future libraries will be technology hubs and hacker spaces, with things like 3D printers and the latest, greatest laptops. People will gather to program code, make artwork and music videos. As for Howden's blog, she says blogs are on their way out. Fortunately, she has a Twitter account. In San Rafael, I'm Holly J. McDeed for Cross Currents.
What's your take on online privacy? Are you worried, or do you think it's a price we have to pay for technological advancement? Call our feedback line at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Jamie Katsoufis, Audrey Dilling, Fatima Duran, Emily Gaddick, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, RTM's Konahovs, Casey Miner, Eric Amu, Nina Nicole, Rena Palta, Mary Reese, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll find out why gas prices make California one of the reddest states in the country.
California uses a different sort of gasoline than the rest of the country. It's a different formulation. It's a more expensive formulation to produce. It's also a cleaner burning formulation.
That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. This is the band Shady Maples. They're playing on Sunday at 2 in the afternoon at Rasputin Records in Berkeley. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.